This is the Microsoft Cloud Show, episode 139. Today's episode is a geek out. Andrew interviews Mark Anderson on the JavaScript development toolchain. Recorded live July the 7th, 2016. Welcome to the Microsoft Cloud Show, the only place to stay up to date on everything going on in the Microsoft Cloud world, including Microsoft Azure, Office 365, SharePoint, and the competitive landscape and related technologies. Just the information, no marketing, no BS. I'm Andrew Connell.
And I'm Chris Johnson.
Send us a tweet, either to the show at MS Cloud Show, or to Andrew at Andrew Connell.
Or Chris at LoungeFlyZ.
As we'd love to connect with you. We're just two dudes telling you how we see it. The Microsoft Cloud Show is sponsored by ValidNL. Valid is a Microsoft Gold partner whose mission is to enable its customers to excel in their business through the innovative use of technology. Valid is always on the lookout for consultants, architects, and engineers. Do you know Azure, Business Intelligence and Analytics, .NET, Office 365, or SharePoint? Look them up on valid.nl. Hey, CJ, it's been a long time since I talked to you.
Yeah, like 45 seconds.
Yeah, something like that. So this episode is a continuation of our last episode, 138, but where I sat down with Mark Anderson at the SP TechCon conference on June the 29th in Boston, Massachusetts. We sat down and we first talked for about 45 minutes on the topic of the SharePoint framework and his thoughts on it, my thoughts on it. So if you're interested in that, go check out episode 138 that came out last week. In this episode, though, I can let the microphone going and Mark and I talked a little bit about JavaScript tooling. So we had actually been sitting in the speaker room and he runs an open source project, his SP services project. I run an open source project for the Office UI fabric for Angular 1. And the two of us, we are both heavy into like JavaScript development, both client side. I do it a lot for server side as well. I know you do it as well, server side, CJ, in your team. And so we thought that, you know, hey, there's this whole wave of stuff coming to people. I did a session at a conference at the conference too, where I was using a Node to host a web server, but it was really the topic of the talk was about Office add-ins and using Angular 2 to build Office add-ins. And I had a lot of people come up to me during the session or after the session about what's my toolchain look like for doing JavaScript development. And I talked to Mark about it. Mark and I were comparing notes and tools that we use. And we're like, yeah, you know what? Let's just turn the microphone on and start talking about it. So I get this question a lot. I hope that by the time that this episode comes out, I have a blog post that is sharing a lot more details around my toolchain. But I'm getting ready to go on vacation for 2 weeks. And so it's kind of why, honestly, it's why we're recording both of these episodes back to back, why you and I said that we only talked to each other in the last 45 seconds.
So yeah.
We're cheating a bit here. But so, hey, before this conversation I had with Mark was about 45 minutes long. So before I do that, CJ, I'd like to ask you and then also share mine a bit, what our tool chains look like. You hear about some stuff that I talked about with Mark, but for you, let me just start off from the get-go. I know that, you know, you and I both are working on projects that are server-side. We're using Node as the underlying kind of runtime. Mm. And we do mixed development. I know some people do mixed development on this, some with OS X on Mac. Some of them are doing it with Windows. But let me ask you this first. You know, what editor is your editor of choice for you and what you see, I guess, the majority of your team using?
Yeah, so first up, I think VS Code. Most of us are using VS Code, but we don't mandate that. Anybody can use any editor they like. It's not specific, you know, to our projects or anything like that. And people, you know, some of our developers have flipped between different tools as well. So it's very much up to the individual. But for the most part, most people are playing around with VS Code. They'll switch off for a while and go try something else. But for the most part, it's VS Code.
Okay. So same here. I'm the same way. I mean, I'm kind of exclusively VS Code as far as my editor goes. I mean, if I need to do anything that's like .NET, I don't know, I guess we have to call it .NET Classic. .NET Classic, where I'm doing any stuff I need to use Windows for, then I'm going to use Visual Studio proper. But yeah, VS Code is my, I actually use VS Code as my primary text editor as well now. I got rid of tools like Atom and Sublime and stuff and just use VS Code for everything.
Yeah, there's a few folks that have used WebStorm from time to time, things like that. But for the most part now, it's VS Code as it's got better and better.
Yeah. Do you have any favorite extensions that you guys have installed in your VS Code that you're a fan of?
Oh, gosh. Not off the top of my head, actually. No. I don't use any. I know that some of our devs do have some additional ones that that they've added, but nothing that pops into my head off. Yeah.
So I'll throw a few of them that I'm a big fan of. If I can grab links to them, I'll put them in the show notes. I know I can. I just don't know if I have time to do it, but I'll put the name of the person that did it too, so you can find it. So one that I'm a big fan of is AddJS.comments. It's by Steven CI, and it's pretty popular. Basically allows me to select either TypeScript or JavaScript method signature, and I just do the command shift P and type in doc, and it adds the JavaScript, the JS doc comment right above it, and automatically stubs out like all the properties and arguments and the return value and stuff like that if I've specified it the types with TypeScript. Another one that I'm a huge fan of is there's an extension called WallabyJS. I'll explain what that is in just when we get back into the typing or the testing stuff when I ask you that question. Another one that I'm a big fan of is called Encode Decode. So this one, I can select like a base64 or whatever kind of encoded string that I have. I can select it, do Command Shift P and type in decode, and it figures out, oh, this is base64, and it just converts it to normal text. So I don't have to copy stuff, run over to something in the browser, paste it in, see the change and stuff. So
that's nice.
Yeah, I was putting a flat spot on my head from banging against the table trying to figure out my source maps problem that are base64 encoded.
Yeah.
So
yeah, that is a pain.
That's another one.
Nice.
And then there's other ones too, for like Circle CI that I use by James Van Dyke, Docker Linter by Enric SJOOH. I can't even pronounce that.
Okay.
And then there's linters and stuff like that. Yeah.
Nice. Yeah, but, it's a cool tool.
Yeah. I take it you for source control, GitHub?
Certainly. Yep.
Yeah. What do you guys use? I'm sorry.
We're all in GitHub. Yeah. That's kind of our go-to place to put stuff.
Yeah. I love the new pricing model too, with private repos is now per person, but you can have unlimited repos.
Yeah, that's pretty nice. I thought that was really interesting. I think it's a very cunning commercial move on GitHub's part.
Oh, absolutely.
Yep. They're getting a lot more bigger companies using it. And so this model works much better for them.
Mm. What do you guys use for automation? Let's say automation for just general tasks, running different things you need done, like compiling, cleaning, vetting. And then also, what do you use for like automating that stuff? So like CI type stuff.
Everything is all TypeScript, right? Our front-end stuff, our back-end stuff, Node, it's all done in TypeScript. So there's a few tools we use on developers' machines. Obviously, everybody runs the stack in Docker, so you can spin up the back-end and the front-end and all that sort of stuff. And we've done some pretty extensive work with Gulp to automate developer tasks, so starting and stopping certain components of the system, restarting things when code changes, compiling TypeScript, doing all that sort of stuff, creating source maps, all those kinds of things, all done in Gulp files, and using Gulp to help automate all that. And so it means it's really easy for a dev to get started. They can Gulp, I forget the command now, I think it's Gulp run or something, certain different types of configurations, and it will spin up all the containers for them and start debugging particular projects and doing all that sort of stuff. So it's pretty easy. We've got a lot of that automated now. And then it's at the dev side of things. When we move into, when somebody commits code, it obviously goes into GitHub, which triggers a continuous integration process. And we do that with Travis CI. Yeah, so Travis picks up the code, uses those same Gulp files, grabs the code, compiles the code, transpiles the code from TypeScript to JavaScript and so forth. The front-end projects use things like Webpack and some other tools, so it runs all those things as well. Then it builds the Docker images in Travis CI and then pushes them up to Docker Hub when it's done. So it tags them with the correct versions and all that sort of stuff, pushes them into Docker Hub, and then that's when Docker Cloud picks up those new images and deploys them to the correct environments automatically. So it's all pretty straightforward end-to-end. Yeah, that's kind of it in a nutshell.
Cool. So I follow a similar process. I have a couple little tweaks to it. I guess it's one of the things that's kind of cool about it is that everybody has their own styles with it. I, too, am doing all of my dev in Docker, and I have the Visual Studio Code set up to where when it spins up the Docker image, I can actually just attach Visual Studio Code to the running instance, and I can debug straight into that. I also use Gulp for a bunch of tasks for things like cleaning out all the build artifacts and logs, for doing transpilation from TypeScript to JavaScript, vetting the code, stuff like that. I have all of my Gulp stuff actually written in TypeScript, including my gulp file, so that I have to first go through and compile that build stuff. And then I have to then compile a second time to build the application stuff to a distribution, like a distribution folder. But it's, I've got it all, I kind of, this is weird. I automate a lot of the stuff using NPM tasks or NPM scripts that use gulp. And so I have kind of a combination of the two and use each one for what it's best suited for. I like that because like with TypeScript, I have one that when I do dev, I use an NPM module called concurrently that will spin up two processes at the exact same time, and that'll run them side by side in two different processes. And that's, I find that to be really tricky to do with gulp. But anyway, once I do a commit with those go up to GitHub. That triggers a Circle CI process, which I know you use Travis. I like Circle for a couple reasons. I like the fact that with Circle, I can, if a build doesn't go right and I want to see what happened, I can rerun the build, but I can enable SSH. And so I can actually use my terminal to connect into the container that the build ran in, and I can kind of poke around and do some stuff. And then that triggers like stuff pushing over to creating the container, sending that up over to Docker Hub, which will get picked up by Docker Cloud to go redeploy it. And so the last thing that I was going to ask you about was testing. So for me, I use Mocha to do all like server-side testing, and Jasmine when I'm doing anything with Angular, because it kind of, their tool, their test runner called Karma, is kind of designed to be used with the Jasmine test framework. So Mocha and Jasmine are just two different ways that you can write your tests using the whole describe and it and all that stuff and expects. And so he's a combination of the two, depending on what I'm building. So Mocha server side, Jasmine if it's client side. I use Karma as a test runner for Angular for like instrumenting browsers and running the browsers to do my tests. And then I use a tool called Istanbul that looks at the tests and looks at the code that's run and gives me a code coverage number to say what lines are being hit and not being hit. But the cool thing is that when I do when I'm working in Visual Studio Code, as I mentioned earlier, I think this is a pick of mine an episode or two ago. I use something called Wallaby JS, and Wallaby is an extension that you install in Visual Studio Code. It is something you have to pay for, but what it does is it is constantly copying my code to a separate like hidden cache folder, running the tests and showing in the little gutter part where breakpoints usually show up. It shows either green or red or gray little buttons that show if a test or the code being tested is actually passing, failing, that's green and red, or if it's not even being covered by a test and that shows up as gray. So that's what I use for testing. It's nice because I don't have to have that running all the time in like a console window. It's now running inside my editor, and it's super, super fast in terms of picking up changes that I make as I'm coding. So really big fan of that.
Wow, that's really cool. Two tools I would mention, RunScope, which is an automated API or HTTP, I guess, automation suite of tools, which we use extensively for testing APIs and in our backend pieces. We use that for testing in our development and staging environments. And then also Ghost Inspector is another online service that we use for automated UI testing. So you can go and do coded tests, but sort of, you know, doing browser automation and actually testing your application running. We don't do any unit testing or anything like that. So it's all end-to-end tests with either UI automation or API automation.
Ah, cool. So I'll make sure that we have in the show notes, we'll have a list of all these different tools. These will be our picks for the week, are the tools and the things that you and I use. So I'll make sure that they're all listed there, stuff that we've mentioned. I'm not going to separate out who uses what. I'm just going to put them all together so people can grab it that way.
Cool. Yeah, there's so many tools in this space and it's a constantly changing environment. I love hearing what people use for things.
Yeah, there's a lot of additional stuff too that we can look at. So I think that now, Huck, we might even, if there's interest in this, then maybe you and I do a geek out and we go even more detail with this instead of just getting an interview going. But hey, this time we're going to do an interview with Mark Anderson again. So again, this is a continuation of my conversation I had with him at the SB TechCon conference. And so let's just go ahead and run that interview because it's got a good 45 minutes or so. So I present you Mark Anderson again. Okay, so Mark, we've just been sitting here talking for the last like 30 or 45 minutes about the SharePoint framework. And you know, one of the things that we are seeing with the SharePoint framework is that it's a very different style of
let's just put in air quotes, traditional SharePoint development, where a lot of stuff's done server-side, even with the whole app model or add-in model, done with Visual Studio, doing a lot of things with server-side code. Maybe it is SharePoint-hosted app and it's all client-side, but it's a very different style of development. One of the things that we've seen, I mean, I know I've spent a lot more time in this area of doing things more with just living in JavaScript and working with more of these open source tools and not using the traditional Microsoft development environments and stuff. And we'll talk about like tools of choice and stuff like that. And I'd love to, as somebody who's been doing this a hell of a lot longer than I have in terms of like the client side dev and had more experience in this area, I'd love to talk to you a little bit here and get kind of and share with our listeners about some of the tooling that they're going to be looking at. And I've seen some videos from like the PNP group and some talks from like on Richard Dzerga and Andrew Coates' podcast on the Office Dev Show, the Office 365 Dev Show, where they talk to Vesa and about the different tooling that's available to us and what you need to do to get ready for this. Mm-hmm. Let's talk through some of this stuff and let's kind of tell people like what the different options are, what the things that are out there. And you know, if you got one that you prefer, I mean, you go out there and say it. I mean, I got ones that I prefer, but I think that one of the things that's really cool about this new style of dev is that we're not to borrow their terms, we're not on a rails experience here of you have to do it like this.
Right.
It's, you know, the SharePoint framework, as you've explained, they're using Webpack, they're using Gulp to go through and do a lot of the automated build stuff, of the building of the different job tasks and stuff that we have to deal with. And then they're using Webpack to go through and to package up and create bundlers and stuff. Those are just options that they've chosen, but we don't have to use that, right? So let's talk about some of this tooling stuff. So I know that, you know, one of the things that we do with this is that when we're used to the old way of doing stuff with Microsoft development, we had a task runner. We never really had to deal with it. It was MS Build. Visual Studio did all that stuff for us behind the scenes, but Visual Studio was never building or compiling our projects or packaging them up. Those were always MS Build tasks. And that was all done using with XML-based definitions, and sometimes they referenced DLLs that were doing some work, but it was all transparent to us.
Yeah.
Today, we do that same stuff. So there's different options that are available to us. I know that you used Grunt for a while. The names here are, I don't know,
it's just ridiculous.
The names are really funny, right? It's some of them are very practical, but some of them are very comical. So you have Grunt, which looks, I think, what was like a warthog or something as the logo.
It's like it does the heavy lifting.
Yeah,
Grunt,
exactly.
You know?
And so that one takes the approach of more what configuration over code.
Yeah.
And so you do more of kind of describing what you want. That follows more the MS Build model in my mind. It uses JSON, but where MS Build used XML. And then, but the model that the SharePoint team is using with the SharePoint framework is Gulp, which is a pretty popular one. That's more it's more code over configuration.
Yeah.
Right. So,
I find some of those distinctions a little tough to make because maybe it's just the way my brain works. You're really good about understanding like all the right terms and all the right frameworks and all the right lingo and stuff, and I'm just horrible at that. I say stuff and things and all that stuff a lot.
Right.
See, I just did it again.
Yeah, it works.
I started using Grunt with and trying to understand how I could break SP services down into some pieces and then build it.
Yeah.
Because I wanted to understand how that worked.
You know,
everybody has to have a GitHub repo or if they ever want to get a job again, right?
Yeah, because pretty much.
That's like the new thing.
Yeah.
It's not a LinkedIn profile anymore.
As you're a dev.
It's right. It's GitHub, right? So, you know, I just wanted to learn it. So I sort of got it sort of figured out. Grunt helps me build things by setting up tasks.
Right.
You know, I can do things like bundle all the JavaScript together.
Right.
Or I could do things like take all the markup document files and convert them to HTML.
Okay.
So those are the kinds of things that you do with these task runners.
Yeah. So it's repetitive jobs that you have that you're going to do. So compile TypeScript to JavaScript or concatenate all the JavaScript together or bundle or minify it.
Or uglify it.
Uglify it, yeah. I love that term. It's like concatenate and uglify.
Yeah. So same there's a vocabulary around all this that we all have to
there
understand.
Is. Yeah, there really is. And this is, and so the reason Mark and I wanted to sit down and talk about this stuff, we talked about it a little bit earlier today and how we were doing it. You run an open source project. I run a small open source project,
right.
and how they're both client side libraries, and that we just to kind of show like comparing what are we doing and stuff. And we thought, SharePoint framework's gonna be doing this too. And this is these are things that I really think that once I started doing more of this stuff, I realized that hey, your air quote, your Microsoft traditional developer. This stuff is foreign to them. So, you know, they make fun of it, right? The traditional C-sharp guy that's been doing ASP.NET, they look at it and they're like, gulp and grunt and Webpack and this and that, you know, this is all, it's all NPM, it's all stupid, and they get all frustrated. That's fine, right? You're going to think that, but the idea here is that you and I want to talk about, I kind of got a little bit cart before the horse. We started talking about some of the task runners and stuff before I said all this, but I think that I want to share this. We want to talk about some of this to show people, like, on these are the different terms and what these tools are. I had a session earlier today where, yesterday, where I had a few people we were done with. I was doing Angular, and they're like, "You're using gulp, and you're using this, and you're using that, and stuff." And they're going, "Do you have anything out there that actually explains how to get up and running with this?"
Yeah.
And it's a big void. It's something that would be really good at a conference like this. But so these things here, like gulp and grunt, whatever, these are task runners.
Right.
And you use them to do different jobs. And so, like we said, like, for example, let's say you have one that's going to go compile your TypeScript. Well, when you do that, there's a couple different things you want done. Maybe you want to vet it. You want to go through and run it through a linter that looks at it and says, you don't have any extra white spaces at the end of your lines. You don't have every comment that starts with the comment characters. You want to have a space after that. You don't want to run it in together. And there's different rules you can do. So maybe you want to do that. Maybe you want to do, and then you want to compile all your TypeScript. And once all the TypeScript has been compiled, while it's being compiled, though, you also want to deal with something called source maps, where you can, the JavaScript that's generated, you want to be able to put a breakpoint in the JavaScript and have that actually be mapped over to a line in TypeScript so you can see, especially if it's minified,
right,
to be able to easily debug stuff. Those are things that you would put inside of your, like, you know, build the project task, and where it would do, like, different steps and writing out the source maps and stuff like that.
So you just listed out a whole bunch of stuff that's going to sound like, you know, Senegalese to a lot of people.
You know, that's a good point. I'm glad you said that.
But the good thing is that, to me, the good thing is that we get to decide how that all works.
Right.
Or we can, because we're dealing with a lot of open source stuff here, we can go out and find examples of how these things work. So here's a task that somebody has published that does an uglification of a directory.
Yep.
You know, so you build tasks at that sort of atomic level, and then you combine them into sort of your pipeline, right? Like, what you might have a build pipeline, a test pipeline, whatever, and then you can start to build those together into bigger pipelines.
Yep.
And so you can really come up with very customized build processes or whatever they are.
Yep.
You know, validation processes, use the word vetting code, right? You can also do things like, well, let's add a header to each one of these files that matches a certain format, because that's the way our code standards work.
That's true.
We can pass it through a linter where we define the rules. What a linter does is sort of looks at your code and says, these are the things you've done badly.
Yeah.
And you need to fix.
Right.
Well, we can
it's
set
like
up
your coding style guide.
Yeah. And it's both style guide and, you know, you've written JavaScript that will actually not work well.
That's true. Performance type stuff.
You haven't defined that. You've declared a variable without. You've used a variable without defining it.
Right.
So that will be bad.
Or you defined it and not used it. It's a waste of code.
Yeah, it's a wasted code, right? So you can set up your linters to do things based on your own corporate standards in addition to just sort of good practices with JavaScript, which you may actually totally disagree with and throw away.
Sure.
I mean, so it's all, you know, it's all open.
Yeah.
And that's actually good.
Yeah.
Because you can start to build out best practices for your organization.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it's just somebody else saying it's a better practice.
Sure, that's true. That's very true.
So that's where a lot of these tools, I think, really get exciting. Mm. And you can also build in your governance stuff for your organization. And so let's say that every time that you deploy to production, you want to take an entire copy of your code base and put it, you name it, wherever.
Yep. Sure.
Right? That can be one of your tasks.
Yeah.
So it can be very specific to what you want to do, as well as sort of generally doing the stuff that people do when they build things.
Sure.
Right? So it can be a lot more.
Yeah.
You know, you can, I think with the SharePoint framework, you can sort of take the vanilla pipeline that they give you, and you may never touch that.
Yeah.
You just, you know, you're a small shop.
It works for me.
At the end, something comes out that works.
Yeah.
Awesome.
But you may want to go through and customize the pipeline to do a lot more stuff, right?
Right.
So Okay, so we talked a little bit about Gulp. We talked a little about Grunt. Yep. Those are basically task runners to automate some stuff. Yep. And there's different ways of doing it. There's what's interesting about this, and I think that this is one of the things that does frustrate some of the people that are getting new to this, is that we see trends change fairly quickly, right, or we see trends kind of emerge and disappear. And so, you look at something like Gulp and Grunt. You know, Grunt was a big deal. Then Gulp kind of took over, and Grunt kind of started to fall by the wayside a little bit. And now I'm starting to see some organizations starting to favor like NPM scripts, and just running like a node project has a file called package.json, and in there you have a script section. So I can define things like start, install, build, run, whatever, so that when I get to the command line, I can say npm, and if it's one of the default ones like start or install, then I just say npm start, and it would do whatever I put in that script. Or like for mine, stuff that I use is I'll say like npm, and then if it's a custom one, I'll say npm run build, and it would go through and compile the entire project and build a library and stuff. So the cool thing is, the thing that I think that people have to kind of look at is that these terms, these technologies are, they're different approaches that people have, and they change. Some things become more popular. It's, you find your own way.
You talked about the distinction between Grunt and Gulp as being configuration over code or code over configuration.
Right.
Whatever.
Yeah,
you know, if one feels better than the other, then you use it.
Right.
These things are going to fall in and out of favor just like those development frameworks do.
Right.
And if you're chasing the shiny penny all the time, you're going to spend so much time learning the next thing that you're never getting any work done.
You're not going to build your project.
Right.
You're going to have a great build process that never builds anything.
I started with Grunt to build SP services as I'm playing around with it. And I hope I ever do a new release, because I'm sort of having fun doing them. And I went to the dev kitchen, I was using Grunt and RequireJS.
Okay.
Which is another, RequireJS is a way to build dependencies between different modules of code.
Right. So it's a module loader.
Yeah. And a bundler if you choose to use it that way.
Okay.
You can sort of compile stuff down. Not compile. It's not really compiling, but it's like compiling.
Transpiling.
Yeah,
converting from one to the other.
We need a new word, right?
Yeah. So that's, and that just for our listeners here. So the difference here between a bundler and a module loader is that think like I have 15 JavaScript files, and one of them depends on five of five, and then another one depends on another three, but there's an overlap or something. It allows you to have a dependency chain, so that when you say, I need this one JavaScript file, RequireJS goes, well, I know that one needs this one, and that one needs this one, and so it goes and pulls all those, and you don't have to remember
in the right order.
In the right order.
Yeah.
And you don't have to make sure that you keep track of all that stuff.
Yeah.
So that's a module loader. The other ones that are out there are things like SystemJS is another popular one, or JSP.
There was one LabJS that's been out there for, I don't know, 5 or 6 years.
Yeah.
So, you know, these things come and go, and one gets better than the other, and because they're open source in most cases, the people who develop them may move on and just forget about it or whatever. So that's part of the game.
It's part of the game, but I think the flip side, that's the negative part of the game. But part of one of the positive parts of the game is that you look at something like Webpack. So Webpack is a bundler. It can also do module loading as well. But Webpack does is it has a different kind of a model than just a bundler, in the sense that it creates this pipeline, and then you can put these different things in the pipeline. So like for me, when I'm doing stuff with like the NG Office UI Fabric project, part of my production pipeline is to, I don't manually compile or transpile the TypeScript to JavaScript. Instead, I have Webpack configured to go to the transpilation side of it inside the project, vet the code, then run all the tests, then do this, do one for production stuff, so a minified library, do one for an unminified library. So that Webpack is one of the options to do that. It's becoming really popular. But see, one of the things I think is really interesting about looking at Webpack is, to go along with the point you just made, I mean, there's a negative side where it's an open source project. The people behind it may just give up and say, I'm done with it, I don't want to work on it anymore. Well, Webpack was done by one guy, and one guy was maintaining it. And so many people started to really adopt it and fall in love with it.
Yeah.
If this guy decides he doesn't want to do it anymore, you see so many organizations putting a dependency on it. Microsoft's doing it. They're using it with the SharePoint framework. Angular was using it for Angular 2. The thing I look at it and say, if so many people are using it and it's so important to their process, somebody's going to pick it up, right?
Right.
And so it's not just going to die. Someone may fork it and go do their own
thing.
That's what happened with JS Hint and JS Lint.
So open source is one of two things. It's either downloaded and complain, which is, I'd say, probably 90% of it,
yeah,
or it's It's look at it and improve it.
Yeah.
Right? It's a way for developers to contribute back to the open source community.
Mm.
Not a lot of developers either want to or can. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean that as a diss. You know,
yeah.
It's just, I got just other stuff to do or whatever. But if, let's take Webpack. You know, if you're working with Webpack and you find a bug in it, hey, you can fix it.
Yeah.
Right? It's try and find a commercial piece of software where that happens.
Yeah.
It doesn't happen. You can report it and it might get fixed in 3 years.
Right.
The world is not like that now.
Yep.
With all this open source stuff, if we want a new feature in Webpack
and
we're willing to build it, awesome.
So it's funny you say that because like you look over at today, you look at the Angular 2 project. There's a thing called the Angular CLI that they're working on. So they're not using so much using a tool called Yeoman to scaffold stuff up. We'll explain what that is in just a minute. But they're not so much using Yeoman to scaffold stuff. They want to have their own tool that scaffolds things up. And it's based on another CLI, another command line interface from something called Ember. Well, when it scaffolds a project up, it uses System.js. That's not a bad one. But there's a huge issue going on in the GitHub repo for the Angular CLI where everyone's like, we want Webpack. We want the option to use Webpack. And they were like, well, you know, I'm not really working back and forth. And there's a guy that's just like going, I'm working on it. And they're starting to add it. Somebody from the community is going and adding it. And a bunch of people are jumping in and trying to help them out. So, I mean, I think that's what's cool about it is that you see something you like, see something you want, go ahead and start adding it. And you know what? If the main part of the community doesn't adapt it or doesn't adopt it, and they don't say that, you know, this is what that I want to add Webpack, and let's say Angular CLI says, no, we don't want to do that. We're going to stick with just JSPM. That's the cool thing about this stuff, the way it works from GitHub and the way it open source is working today. You fork it, you have your own copy of it.
You build the next thing.
And that's and we have one today. We have a really good example of that happened today where there was something called JS Lint that had very strict rules for JavaScript, and it conformed all
I think its slogan was, JS Lint will make you cry or something like that.
Yeah. And so it was forcing.
Nobody's code was good.
No, and it made you work in a certain way, and the community was like, we want to be able to have our way to go through and define our own linting rules, and the guy wouldn't do it. He wouldn't budge. And so someone took his project, forked it, renamed it to JS Hint, and added the ability for everybody to use it. JS Hint's what we all use. We don't use JS Lint anymore. We all use JS Hint.
Right.
So it's an interesting story. Now,
well, it's interesting because people always think open source, it's awesome, it's free.
Yeah.
Well, it's free if you're a taker, right?
Yeah.
And of course, it's not free because you take it and then you got to figure it out and you got to adapt it for yourself.
Yeah, usually the documentation's not so great.
Yeah, you know, you get what you get. So if you contribute back, that's actually part of the cost of that software. If you're actually contributing and helping other people out, then the ecosystem works.
Yeah, it does. And we're speaking a bit in absolutes too. Don't think every open source project that you're in on, you've got to contribute back to it, right?
No. Some won't take your contribution.
So I'm a big user of open source stuff, but I've also found a couple things and I go to try and help and contribute some things. A couple projects I've run, but I don't contribute back to everything. Yeah. But it's...
You're definitely going to take more than you're going to contribute to.
Absolutely.
But if something becomes important to you
and
you want to contribute,
you know,
you want to write the next left pad,
do
it.
I want to make it easy. I want to make it easier. So another thing that we looked at here that I know the SharePoint framework uses is something called Yeoman.
Yep.
So Yeoman is a project scaffolding tool. So very much like when you go into Visual Studio, you say file, new project, pick it, and it templates everything out. That's really what Yeoman is. It really just lets you pass in a few inputs. And then it goes through and creates a boatload of files for you. Mm-hmm. Well, I should say a boatload. It depends on the project. But
it's often a boatload.
Yeah, it's often a boatload. But it goes and creates a bunch of files for you to make it so that starting a new project isn't the same as create a new folder. Okay, now it's a series of new file, type everything up. It's going to stub a bunch of stuff out for you. Makes your life a little bit easier.
Right.
Yeoman's founded on the concept of these things called generators. And so you build a generator that you pass in, that you download. So you install Yeoman on your machine. Then you install, I guess one thing we should talk about is Node a little bit, because all these tools are Node-based tools.
Node seems to scare everyone because it's like, well, wait, I'm running a server on my PC. What's that about?
Node is just simply a way, at its very core, Node is a way to run JavaScript on your machine and not in the browser. Node has taken the V8 engine from Chrome, the V8 JavaScript engine from Chrome, and has added some API layers around it so that you can talk to the file system, you can talk to the network and stuff like that. That's all it is.
But it's interesting because people say, well, I've got to go and learn Node.
Yeah.
You actually don't ever have to learn Node.
Yeah.
You just have to have Node installed to run all of these other tools. things, right?
You can be that minimal.
So there's no learning Node necessarily. I mean, you can definitely go there, but...
Yeah. It's like if you want to go, if you want to use, trying to think of an example here, I'm blanking a bit, but if you built a .NET application and I want to use it, I have to go install the .NET framework,
right?
But then I can use your application. I don't have to learn .NET. I just have to install the underlying core.
Exactly.
So yeah, so what the SharePoint team has done is they built a generator and they've published their generator. The same thing that we did for Office add-ins. We built a generator for Office add-ins called where you just would, once you install Yeoman and then you'd install the Office generator, you'd say yo space office at the command line, ask you some questions, it would stub out a project for you. The same thing's true with the SharePoint generator too. So you've seen this, you've actually worked with it a little bit. I know that they're working on some stuff. If you wanted to create your own generator,
you
by all means could do that and stub out your own project. And it's so much easier than creating your own templates in Visual Studio, like we, for project templates in Visual Studio, we used to in the past.
I think, you know, and I look at something like Yeoman and I, you know, when I first heard about it, it was like, what the hell is this?
Yeah, right?
I mean, you know, the name, of course, always is sort of weird. But, you know, if you think about, I thought about it from a content management standpoint. You know, when I go to create a new contract for one of my clients, if I go grab one of my old contracts and then try and get the client name out and make sure I get all the dates and stuff right, I screw up, right? So what Yeoman does is it's like having a template for a content type in SharePoint, right?
Yeah.
Every time I start a new one, I get the new template.
Yeah.
And if the template's changed, then I get the changed template.
Yeah.
So I'm always getting the best starting point for my project.
Yeah.
It's like what you've done in Visual Studio, but I think it's more of a living thing. You know,
I totally agree with that.
The yo something is out there somewhere and it's being maintained by people and improving in theory.
Yeah.
You know, so you're always getting the best starting point for this kind of project.
Yeah, and under the covers, the way it's implemented, for those of you who aren't familiar with it, is when you install Yeoman, that's a Node package. Yeah. So you've got Node installed, that's a Node program. So you've installed Node on your laptop and then you say npm space dash g to install it globally, or npm I for install dash g to install it globally, and you give it the name. So like here it would be maybe a yo SharePoint, or sorry, generator dash SharePoint. And that'll download from the npm registry, the generator, and now Yeoman can use it. So you can create your own. When it downloads that generator, it's downloading as an npm package.
Right.
That npm package is tied to usually a GitHub repository. And so, like you said, there may be an update to it. And so when you see that there's updates, you can do npm-outdated, and it shows you, here's a list of all the packages you have that are all outdated, and you can go get the newest and latest greater one.
And part of what Yeoman gives you is all of the dependencies for that project.
Right.
The things that you're going to need.
Right.
So like, for instance, all of the dependencies in the gulp tasks.
Mm-hmm.
If Microsoft adds a new gulp task that uses some other npm module, then it'll be part of that yo.
Waiting for the next version of the Visual Studio developer tools to come out. Yeah.
And this can just keep going.
Yeah.
You know, this is not real time because you don't really want it real time. You can decide when to take that next yo.
Yeah.
Next version of the generator. Right?
Yeah.
But like, so it's sort of applying source control to that idea too.
Yeah.
So all of these pieces are moving all the time,
yeah,
which I think is what throws people off a lot.
I think so too.
You know, I figured some of this stuff out. The reason we're even talking today is Andrew showed me some of the stuff that he's put together. Man, it's like, ooh, my hair's blowing back. Awesome stuff. But you know, you said, I mean, you're a very smart guy, but you spent 3 days on it.
I did,
right? And that was part of what you showed me,
right?
But it's not like this is impossible. It's not like people seem to think that learning a new thing is incredibly horrible.
Mm.
But if you pick away at which pieces, you know, you don't need to learn all of these different things. You know, let's learn Grunt and Gulp and Webpack and System.js and all these other things on the same day. That's not how you do it.
No.
And you can, if you have a team, you can split up the responsibility for these things. You've been doing this stuff for years.
Yep.
These are just different tools.
The cheese has just been moved a bit. But the other thing I think that's cool about it, though, is that it's all in the clear. It's all in the open. It's all open. When we keep saying open source, but one of the advantages to all of these tools, I think, that because they're all written, they're all based on Node. One of the cool things about that is that there's no compilation with Node. So there's no compiled binary or anything like that. You get the source. It's all done in JavaScript. Mm-hmm. So if you don't like the way something works, or you're trying to understand how something works, the best way to do it is to go look at the source of what they did, see what they're expecting, and see what they're doing with it. I had that with part of my build process from our project. It was driving me crazy. I'm like, how in the world are they, why is this not working? And I was able to go in and actually figure out what they were doing. I didn't agree with what they were doing, but I was trying to use it in a different way. But it's like, well, that's how it works. So if I want to play that game, then I have to play by their rules. That's fine.
Yeah.
So I think that, you know, some of the stuff where it gets really cool here, like the build process I was showing you, I've written a post about it. We'll put a link to it in the show notes. But it's a process that we use for the NG Office UI Fabric, where, before I explain this, one of the things that's always been incredibly frustrating to me as a developer, or actually better to say terrifying, is deployments. I am terrified of deploying. I'm almost as scared of them as much as I am scared of sharks and snakes. I'm terrified of snakes. But the thing that has gotten me over my fear is that when I do a deployment, I don't do big deployments. I do very small deployments.
Yeah.
And I do them very often. And so it's very easy to know this. The more frequently you ship and the smaller things that you ship, the less of an impact you can have, but you also have a lot more confidence in what you're shipping.
Right.
And to me, one of the thing that usually fails when you do one of these deployments is things are not repeatable, or you're doing it in a very manual way, and it's easy to forget a step. And so what we've done is that we've integrated a couple of things. I'm going to throw a few pieces out there, and we can pick it apart if you like. But what we did is that, you know, we use Gulp to go through and to automate it. We use a combination of Gulp and NPM tasks to do certain things. We then have selected a CI tool, a continuous integration tool, that there are three really popular ones. There are two very popular ones out there. I'm using one that's probably not as popular. It's popular, but it's not as popular as the two.
Oh, my God. You didn't pick the most popular one? Isn't that the reason we make these choices?
You know, I did. We did it first, and then we pivoted because we liked the UI of the one we chose. So we originally were using something called Travis CI. Travis is free. You pay for it for private repositories, but it's free. What Travis has one, another one that's really popular is called Jenkins. The one that I use that I'm partial to is called Circle CI. And what these are hosted solutions. And what happens is that they're going to watch your different source code repositories. And when they see you do something, like for me, I've got it set up as whenever there's a push to any branch in our repository, I want you to reach in, pull a copy of the way it is right now, and do some stuff. And some of them have ways of you can configure it through the browser. Some of them have ways you do it through a file. I prefer to do it through a file, through like an instruction file. Usually they use a file format called YAML. It's YAML. And it really is, it looks very much like an any file. It just uses indentation to go through and to define stuff.
Yeah.
So I have a circle .yaml file, a YML file, inside my repository, and it tells it to do all these different things. It says, you know, I want you to do all this, run all this stuff on a container based on node version, whatever. I want you to create these folders. I want you to go, after you grab the repository, here's how you run the tests. Here's how you vet the code. Here's how you do this. There's a pre and a post step. And it goes through this whole automated process. And if anywhere along the way, there's an error. So in my test framework that we use, that whenever the tests don't pass, it actually exits out and does the standard return of a 0 or 1 if things pass or fail.
Right.
If that fails, then the build fails. So CircleCI is like going, we're stopping right here. So that's where you hear people say, oh, the guy broke the build. And that's why you got big red flashy lights go, or big green flashy lights. And it's like,
or you get a message in Slack.
Or you get a message in Slack.
An email or whatever.
Yeah. And that stuff, what that does is that now, for us, when we do a push to master, Circle kicks off, does a build, make sure everything, the code's vetted, make sure all the tests pass. Every time for us, because we're using, it's all done, all of our build process is done in Node, we delete the Node modules folder, and we re-download everything again. So everyone, it's a clean copy. It's like I'm starting up a brand new image every time. And then if it's, we do other checks to see, say, here's the deployment process. And so our deployment process that I really like, I was inspired by what they do at the Angular Material Project, is that we look at the version number in the package.json file, and we look at the most recent tag in the GitHub repository. It basically says, if those two versions are different, then that indicates that this is a new version that we've just pushed. And so we need to do some work to it. So first we tag it, we push that up to GitHub, but then we compile it, We pull in another project that has where we used to distribute things to NuGet, that we used to distribute things to through Bower, through NPM, and through CDNJS. We pull those in, we copy the compiled libraries over to them, and we push those back up. The cool thing about this, I mean, it's a bit of a complicated process. Go read the blog post that we'll link to in the show notes. You can go take a look at it. But the thing that this enables us to do is that it allows me to know that when I sat down, I was like, going, hey, look, I got a PR that I know is in pretty good shape, a pull request by one of our developers on the team. I was like, I'm gonna run all my tests, and if everything passes, I know his style. He's one of our leading developers, so I don't need to go look at his code. I'm gonna merge it on master and do a push. We did a push and walked away, and 5 minutes later, we had rolled out
new updates. Well, you broke it.
Well, I did break
showing
it.
Me.
I was like, "Let me look. You could even do this." And I made one mistake and I actually stopped the build.
He stuck his finger in the middle, which was the problem. But it actually did work.
It did work. I restarted it without my finger in the middle, it was fine. But yeah, it's pretty cool though, because it just everything deployed into quote unquote production.
You know, it's interesting because I was thinking as you were going through all of that, and good Lord. What he just described, if you looked at the code, I mean, it's beautiful.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful thing. You're going to love the blog post. But I worked with a team probably 4 years ago who were building SharePoint solutions, and they were trying to do not continuous builds, but builds every day or every week or, you know, frequent builds because they wanted to get to this. And they struggled like crazy because doing a clean build and a dot, you know, in the dot net, not
dot net,
that thing, that space was actually pretty hard.
It was hard, right? and with all the SharePoint dependencies that they're so tightly coupled with it, it makes it incredibly hard.
You needed a SharePoint machine to run the build, and you needed to figure out how to like wipe the damn thing clean every time. And it was actually really hard. They were stymied, and I respected these guys. They knew what they were doing. This is better.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, what you've been able to do in that build process using some of the tools that you just ran through most of them.
Yeah.
And some that we haven't really covered all that much, really gives you a lot of control and power. Right?
It does.
As a developer, it helps you be better at what you do because it gives you feedback closer to to where you are than, oh, it's out there and the users are using it and crap, it doesn't work.
Yep.
Because the build might not work.
Yep.
Or, you know, the linting may fail, in which case you might just want to stop your build because it's like, wait a minute, we're violating our rules here.
We do. Make it. If you don't pass, you don't go.
Yep. So it actually, in some ways, is better than a compiler because you don't write the rules of the compiler, right? I mean, the compilers are trying to help you be better.
Yeah.
They're actually more trying to just squish the stuff down into a DLL or whatever.
Yep.
It's really not about giving you tangible feedback.
Yeah, they're there to do a job. They're not there to help you. They're there to actually build something. Right. They're not there to look at your code and say things are good, you can do better here and that kind of stuff.
Yeah. So, you know, you can take things as far as Andrew has, and I'm going to steal some of this code.
Oh, no, please.
Absolutely.
It's, you know,
it's open source.
Please take, like I said,
you look at
the material design one, man.
You can, and I think a lot of people will, you know, with the SharePoint framework or a lot of other things that they may end up doing in this kind of development space, they'll just take the simplest path.
Yep.
And that's not bad either.
No, it's not.
You know, you want to match the path to your business requirements. Again, business requirements.
Sure.
Right? But you can get so specific with how you want stuff to work, and it can work really, really well. Developing this way versus the way it can work with .NET. I think it's a better story.
I do too.
I know you're convinced about
it. I'm totally convinced of it. You know, and I think that one of the things that I found in getting into this more, I mean, let's be honest, you know, continuous builds, continuous integration, it's not impossible to do on like with a traditional Microsoft stack when you're doing like if you're Visual Studio and you're ASP.NET and you're using like say TFS, that's all of this stuff is completely possible to do, and it's not any harder or any easier to do it like that, right? But what we're talking about really is more in the context of like SharePoint, right?
Yeah.
Because a lot of our listeners, I think, are more SharePoint devs. and they don't have as much experience in this space as well, because doing that CI, doing a continuous integration, doing tests and automated builds and everything, it is very hard for SharePoint. Even some of the smartest, like Chris O'Brien, has done a phenomenal job with the work that he did. I mean, many years ago, I remember him working with Mike Morton at Microsoft on a 12-step. Here's how you go through and get the to get continuous
builds.
Wonder
why it was 12 steps.
You know, I said the same thing, right? But well, they came out happy on the other end. Yeah. So I agree. But this stuff is easier. It's not. It sounds intimidating.
Absolutely,
I've been through it, but.
It's still intimidating to me, and I'm, you know, a good way down the journey. You know, now that I've seen your stuff, it's like, oh, I'm going to be better at this now.
Well, and there's so much stuff you can end up building. The cool thing now is there's so many projects that actually do it. When you look at the really big open source projects, they're all doing this. They're all doing it because they have to, right? I'm the only one that manages the builds for my project. You're the only one that manages the builds for your project. But if we have other people that are involved in it, you can't have, oh, this is the way Mark does it. This is the way Andrew does it. It's, this is the way the project does it. And to automate and have that stuff documented, when you instrument all that stuff, it's self-documented. It explains the process, how it goes. It's almost, someone looks at, we had somebody that was looking to do the same kind of thing for projects at their organization. They're like, how in the world do you do all this? It kind of goes in the flow. And I'm like, this is where you start pulling on the thread. You start right here. And then just start following all the files along. And you can see what's being imported. You can see what the environment variables are. And you can go to Circle and you can see some of the old builds that have happened and see all the process. You can click on each one of the different steps and see the output from what happened. I think I've never done development like this. I mean, I've been doing this stuff now for a couple of years. Before that, I was never doing development like this. And it makes the deployment side for me. I have so much more confidence in it. Mm. But it also gets it out of my head to where I don't have to remember how to do that stuff. I haven't done a push in about a month for our project. We hadn't had a PR. You and I sat down. The last one we looked at, I think, was on June the 7th. Today is June the 29th. We're recording this. And I went to do it, and I was just like, and there was one command that I was trying to remember. But of all the stuff...
Your fingers hesitated for at least a half a second.
Yeah, and I was like, yeah, funny. But I was like, there's one little thing we could do here. But the whole process, it built and deployed the exact same way.
99.something% of what happened was automated.
Yeah.
You typed a few things to start it because you wanted to, I mean, you don't want this stuff, in your case, you don't want it to just happen without you knowing it's going to happen.
Right. So, I mean, if I told you, you're familiar with Git.
Yeah.
And if I told you, Mark, you're going to take the project over, you don't have to know how the build process goes, but as long as you push... to master, just do an code update, add it, commit it.
Oh, and you
push
have,
to master.
Well, you have done a crazy, crazy thing there. You've actually put comments in your code.
Oh, that's
it.
A
lot
radical.
Of people don't do that.
That's amazing.
It's a waste of bytes, is what that is.
I strip the comments when I build. Don't look at the compiled work.
No, but seriously, if you look at the artifacts that we're talking about here, you know, Andrew has got, you know, nice little segments of code, and you can tell what they're doing and their messages that come out of them. So building all of these little pieces up and combining them together into this sort of feeling like a massive process only works if you write good code.
It does.
I mean, you know, just like anything else. I mean, I think all of us need to strive to be better coders so that these tools work well for us.
Yeah.
Right? If we write a bunch of crap that nobody can decipher, it's going to be just as bad in this new environment as it is in the other environment.
Not only that, man, but I mean, a lot of the projects, I don't care if it's a production project, I don't care if it's a corporate intranet, I don't care if it's an open source project you're working on, you're going to step away from it for a few weeks at a time, right?
That's one of the painful things.
Yeah. You come back and you look at it and you're trying to like, what the hell was I doing here? How did it work? I mean, you got to make it easy to come back and see it real quick. And that's why we did that build process like that, because I got to the point where I was like, I didn't dread, but I'd be like, oh man, I got four PRs here. I was like, I got to make sure I pull my OneNote out and make sure I get this process done the right way.
Those documents that you have taped to your wall by your computer that, like, you got to go down the list.
I'll make sure I do this right.
84 steps.
Going out of town, what do we do? Turn the air conditioners up, turn the fans off, turn the hot water heater off. It's like, no, I just want to say I'm away.
Well, it's like home automation for your code.
It really is.
I mean, if you're into that sort of thing, it's sort of the same thing. Hey, house, light up for a party.
Yeah.
You know?
You know what? I'll sum it up in this. It's one of those things that you look at and you're like, I don't know if I want to go through the process to do that. But I've yet to come across one person that's done it and say, I wish I hadn't done that.
Yeah.
I wish we hadn't automated all that stuff.
Well,
once I've done it, this, I spent those 3 days learning this. I've used this similar process on a bunch of knowledge. I just copy and paste
it. One of the things that you probably got out of that is because you had to implement this using the tool sets, you actually came up with a better process.
I did.
You know, I always say a process observed is an improved process, right?
Yeah.
When people ask me to write a workflow in SharePoint, I'm not ever writing a workflow for the way they used to do it.
Right.
I'm writing a workflow for the way they're going to do it.
Right.
Right. And that's what these tools actually help you do.
Yeah.
They bring better process to what you're doing because you have to think through the process.
Yeah.
Right? So lots of times teams don't really have a lot of norms and they don't really have a lot of consistent ways of doing things. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they like that.
Mm-hmm.
But in the long run, it's better. You're better off if you've got some consistent ways of having things happen.
I think so.
You know, the continuous integration thing just makes good sense.
It really does.
You know, every time the thing fires off, it's going to tell you whether things are good or not.
Yeah.
And if you wait weeks between those instances, because you know, you're all just too busy.
Yeah.
You're going to have a pile of spaghetti.
I think so.
You know, every piece of code is going to have been touched.
Yeah.
You won't know if the dependencies are still working right. You won't know if, you know, Bob's been consistent where Betty changed something. And if you have the continuous integration going on, you get hints about that really fast.
You really do. And it stops. It's your gating function too.
Yeah.
It stops things from everybody from continuing on so that you don't screw other people up along the road.
Right.
Or you find a bug. And first thing you do, you go write a test.
Right.
We get a bug filed for our library all the time. I should say all the time. We get it every once in a while. And when we immediately go in, first step, go write a test that fails, right. that simulates the exact same thing that they're seeing.
So you do end up writing code that isn't your code.
Absolutely.
Right? You write tests, you write the code that runs the tools,
yep.
or that drives the tools,
yep.
your process.
Yeah.
So yes, you do end up writing code that doesn't have anything to do with what you're implementing.
Yep.
And that, I think, frustrates people sometimes, too.
It does.
But it makes you better at that, at the actual core job.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's just like I used to write batch files.
Yeah.
I used to work on faxes.
Mm-hmm.
And I would write a lot of batch files on faxes that would do this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Because it made good sense. You know, we're publishing whatever to something over and over and over again. Let's not screw it up by typing the wrong character.
Right. You know? Let's look at it in the big picture. You got to go run a bunch of errands, right? Do you think about the errands that you need to run and where and the order you're going to go run those errands and then figure out the path that you're going to drive?
You and I do that. My wife doesn't.
Well, your wife, I don't think she's on the audience, so we're okay on that one.
No, I'm good.
Lost your wife contention.
I think I'm good here. She would never have made it to this point in this podcast.
Neither would mine. But you think about it. What's my plan? I'm going to go here
right.
first. I'm going to go here first.
Try to be efficient at what you're doing.
Yeah.
Try to follow. You know that a certain intersection is always there's too much traffic. Let's try to avoid that.
Yeah.
It's the same kind of thing.
It's exactly the same.
We apply this to thinking to our lives all the time.
And in the big picture, you get done what needs to get done faster. I think that, I mean, yeah, writing all the tests and everything, it can cause a lot more time. And we have like 500 and some odd tests inside of the library in the NG Office UI Fabric. Did it take a lot of time to write those? Yeah, it did. But I know that when I was also writing the generator for the Yo Office generator, we have something like 400 or 500 tests in that one too, or 300, somewhere around there. I know when I was running it, it was building out a bunch of files, and it was really tedious for me to go through and, all right, let me see what it actually created. Let's make sure that's what it was supposed to create. No, it was go do it. And it'd go through and create a new temp thing, and it would build it all out, and it would run it, and it'd come back, and it's like going, nope, these things aren't where they're supposed to be. We expected this. And you go,
well,
okay, cool.
And in the long run, what does this get you? It gets you better software delivered to your customers.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter who your customer is, whether it's, you know, a client, an external client, or yourself or whoever. You know, you're going to be delivering a better product.
Right.
You're going to be more consistent about it.
Yeah.
I remember many times before we wrote a bunch of that stuff on the Vaxes back in the day, you know, we'd push the button and go, ooh, we forgot. You know, you never would remember the thing until you push that button.
And
right?
then it comes flying forward.
Right. So if that process is set up right, it stops because you forgot that thing.
Yeah.
You know.
Makes it easier.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's. Cool. I think it's all good. It's scary.
Yeah.
But it's all good.
It's stuff. It's something new. It's something new to bite off, but it's not. It's not bad. It's
and
not
there,
bad.
And there are a lot of people who know how to do this out there.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we didn't even talk about, you know, what does this mean for the market and software, right?
Oh.
But, you know, we can go out and we can find people who've done this sort of stuff with web development.
Yeah.
Bring them into our development teams. They're going to add a whole dynamic to it that, you know, if we keep our eyes and ears open and actually are open-minded about it, we can be much better at what we do.
You can do that. You can take time doing, like, you can go look at the, go find some of these big projects, some of these more popular.
I know you're always trolling the big projects for great ideas.
Well, I mean, on GitHub, you can actually sign up to a weekly email you get from them that are the trending projects on GitHub.
Yeah.
And go look at that. Go find the language that you're interested in and see how they do it. I mean, my build process is not too unique. It is almost a fork of what the Angular Material Project does. They take it even further, where they build out all their docs and they build out their demos and everything on the fly as well.
You're going to do that next week, though, right?
Well, I don't know about next week, but that's the goal for the NG Office UI Fabric, so that we'll have a better site that has a better demos. And when someone builds a new component or changes stuff, and they change the way that they change the demo, this one's a bit of a tangent here. We'll wrap up on this one, but they're working on stuff for the Angular 2 version, Angular UI Fabric, and they actually have some stuff that they're working on so that it will have an expected page of here's how it's supposed to look, and then it'll go use the new directive or component they created and all this stuff. It actually can do screenshot diffs of the two.
Wow.
And so when you do a build and it runs all the tests, and then it actually goes through and tries to make some changes to it, if the screenshot changes from build to build or it doesn't match what the main thing's supposed to do, that's treated as an error and treated as a bug. And it's like, no, the test didn't pass because the UI doesn't look the right way. We've actually run into that with our project a few times where we've done stuff and things were fine, but then we realized that going, oh no,
pixels this way or whatever.
Things aren't working the way they're supposed to be working. It's cool, but I mean, it's a lot. I looked at it, it's like, it's a lot of extra work to figure it out. But they're like, yeah, we're trying to build a framework that everybody else can use. I'm like, sweet, I'll take it. I'll be a consumer. If I find a bug,
I can't wait for that to come along.
Exactly. Cool. Well, hey, thanks, man. Do you have anything else you want to wrap up with this?
Or no, man, this has been fun.
Yeah.
This has been fun. You know, it's
tooling geek out.
We just have a great time sitting down and talking, and
absolutely.
We happen to record it sometimes, and that's a lot of fun.
I
appreciate it.
Cool, man. Good time. Appreciate you taking the time to talk about this with me, and hey, enjoy the rest of the show.
Yeah, it's a fun one.
Awesome. Thanks, Mark.
Did you like this episode? Send us a tweet about it and drop us a 5-star review in iTunes. Word of mouth recommendations are the most effective ways for us to grow the show. We'd really appreciate it. If you have a question for us, go to microsoftcloudshow.com/questions, where you can submit it as text or record it as a WAV or an MP3 and provide a link so that we can play your question on the show. Our theme music is an excerpt from Evaporated Air by Monk Turner, used under Creative Commons. You can subscribe to us in iTunes and the Google Play Store by searching for Microsoft Cloud Show or via RSS at microsoftcloudshow.com, where you'll also find show notes of each episode. You can also find us on Facebook, searching for Microsoft Cloud Show, or on Twitter at MS Cloud Show. And finally, sign up to our mailing list by heading to our website and entering your email to interact with us, participate in upcoming interviews, and other cool stuff. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.